Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the link between nutrition, diet, and type 2 diabetes. The World Health Organization says that there are four times as many people with the disease today than there were just 30 years ago. Type 2 diabetes is often called a lifestyle disease, with inactivity and an unhealthy diet greatly increasing the risk of developing it. Food is a central part of the cause and appears to be a major part of the solution. We'll be asking what role the food industry has played in the huge rise in cases and what role it might play in bringing them down. Joining me today is a leading expert in diabetes and nutrition. Roy Taylor is Professor of Medicine and Metabolism at Newcastle University and recently retired as consultant at Newcastle Hospitals NHS Trust. He's done a huge amount of work in this area, showing that type 2 diabetes may be reversible and clarifying what causes it and how it works. Welcome to the podcast, Roy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
That's a great pleasure. Now, first of all, if you can just let's get an overview of this. Can you just outline for me exactly what diabetes is, how the disease works, and what is the fundamental cause?
Well, the word diabetes really refers just to the fact that blood sugar levels are increased. And there are two main types. So let me outline those first, just to focus on what we're actually talking about. Childhood type diabetes, or type 1 diabetes, always needs insulin injections. That is due to a completely different cause, and so we ought to set that aside right from the start. It rarely can come on in adult life, so it's not particular for children, but it's not what we're talking about just in this program. Type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, is known to be a lifelong condition. It tends to come on in adult life, although recently, with the advent of very large children, especially in the United States, the incidence of type 2 diabetes in children is rising alarmingly. Now, because the sugar is raised, that causes the well-known symptoms of feeling thirsty, passing a lot of urine, and perhaps getting more infections than usual. But the real problem, are the long-term problems. Complications such as premature heart disease, such as kidney failure and trouble with the eyes, but it's really the premature heart disease that is the major problem, closely allied, especially in some communities, with the increased risk of amputation. So this is an extremely unpleasant disease, and the younger one is when it comes on, paradoxically, the worse the complications are. So we're looking down the barrel of a gun here with the advent of childhood type 2 diabetes. It is potentially going to really affect the health of all nations.
So when we look at the role of food in diabetes, what is the connection?
Well, the connection really is crystal clear. Too much food, increased incidence of type 2 diabetes. So we can look across communities and start, for instance, with subsistence farmers who are just growing enough to be able to feed themselves, give themselves enough energy to dig the fields, do it all again the following year. Now, in those communities, type 2 diabetes is almost unknown. On the other hand, when those same genetically determined people are moved off the land and provided with food, type 2 diabetes becomes absolutely rife in those people. Now that gives us a big hint. Yes, there is a genetic determination of type 2 diabetes, but hang on, it only comes on in a condition of food excess. So, as I say, there is a crystal clear link.
And is there a sort of social aspect to it? What are the demographics of type 2 diabetes? How much does education and income and geography affect your likelihood of developing it?
The demographics really reflect the demographics of the background population. Let's wind back 3 or 4 decades, when type 2 diabetes tended to be a disease of more affluent people. These days, it tends to be a disease of less affluent people. Now, why should that be? It's merely because the access to effectively unlimited food was once a province of people who could afford it. With the advent of cheaper food, that has turned the tables, and now it's the cheap processed foods, which typically are more easy to access in low socioeconomic groups, that are driving the epidemic. And so we've seen a complete volte-face. So it's nothing to do with being bright or being educated. It's really being a child of one's own economic and food environment.
Now, if we look at the relationship between nutrition and diabetes, I guess we have to look at the advice that people get. And there's a world of difference between a clinical nutritionist and a kind of a TV sofa nutritionist. I wonder if you have a view on how the difference between these two advisors, shall we say, can affect how diabetes is treated.
Yes. If one goes onto social media or just gets information from the media, you may get a very wide range of opinion about this. Now, a lot of people who call themselves nutritionalists don't really have formal training in that, but have got major interests in food, and perhaps their views are perhaps less soundly based than those who have a formal qualification, such as a registered dietitian. But also, I have to point out that all our knowledge, recent knowledge about type 2 diabetes, is recent, and it's taken the dietetic profession a while to turn around and to accept some of the principles which we've been able to demonstrate in the research over the last 14 or 15 years. So I think one has to be very careful where one gets one's information about nutrition. And of course, I have to say that I hope that the information contained in this podcast comes with considerable authority.
I'd hope so. You are Professor of Medicine and Metabolism, so you're the man for the job. So now this is particularly interesting for me because there's a lot of information that says there is no cure or way of reversing diabetes. But you've been working on this area, haven't you? And can you tell me a little bit about what you found?
Yes, that's indeed what we might call the old view of type 2 diabetes. And indeed, all doctors believed it implicitly because it panned with what individual doctors saw in the clinic. Once a person had type 2 diabetes, they seemed always to have it, and it got steadily worse, needing more and more tablets and eventually insulin. So it became labelled as an irreversible chronic disease. But I was working upon how insulin affects food distribution in the body and how it affects different organs, and particularly focusing on the liver, which is really the central computer, as it were, to guide where foodstuffs go in the body. And the idea occurred to me in 2006 that, in fact, there might be a very simple explanation for type 2 diabetes. It wasn't the complex, heterogeneous disease that other experts thought it was. But it might be all explained by just a little bit of extra fat. And so it was that idea, which I wrote up as a hypothesis in 2008, the twincital hypothesis, that we worked upon and led to all the discoveries.
Can you tell us a little bit more about these discoveries?
Yes. The twincital hypothesis suggested that type 2 diabetes only occurs when people have been eating just a little bit more than their bodies required over quite a long period of time. That might be just an extra mouthful of food a day, not very much. And it would particularly occur in people who didn't respond very well to insulin in their muscle tissue. Let me jump aside a moment to say, after your breakfast this morning, Stefan, I hope you would have stored one third of the carbohydrate you'd eaten in your muscles as muscle glycogen, and that would peak 5 hours after eating. That's what we found out when we used special magnetic resonance techniques, a bit like MRI, but actually following the carbon around the body. That's in people with normal insulin sensitivity. Now, we've known for a long time that people who are relatively less sensitive to insulin and muscle, have insulin resistance, as it's called, tend to get type 2 diabetes, Well, they're the very people who have to put more of each breakfast, each dinner, each lunch into fat for temporary storage, because glucose can't be allowed to wander around unchecked in the blood, because it is unpleasant stuff that does damage. So people with insulin resistance store more fat. And where does it happen? Guess what? It's in the liver. And that's where we started. And because it's in the liver, it stops insulin working so well. And that's why glucose starts slowly rising. And it continues to rise, just month by month, year by year, very slowly through the normal range and onwards. But of course, it's not just that. At the same time, the level of fat is building up. And that fat spills over. If you can store it in the fat under the skin, well, that's fine. But if you reach a certain level of capacity, then it spills over and gets stored where it shouldn't be in the body. One of those places is the pancreas. And I knew from some very old classic work from a fabulous American physiologist called Roger Unger that chronic exposure of insulin-producing cells to fat would actually blunt their ability to respond to sugar. And that's exactly what we were seeing. So the idea was that there were two cycles, and they would mutually interact and drive each other on. So two vicious cycles, which were turning very slowly, but it was a simple explanation of diabetes. More fat than an individual can bear, diabetes. So that was the twin cycle hypothesis, and it was widely regarded as very interesting, but highly unlikely. So of course, we had to go out and try and destroy it. That's what science has to do. The critical sin, the cardinal sin, is to fall in love with your own hypothesis. No, you need to try and destroy it. And we could do this with the twin cycle hypothesis quite simply. Let's cut off its head. Stop this excess of food intake and also go through a period of low calorie, which would strip the fat out of the liver. And we could see what would happen. We predicted the blood sugar would fall, the liver fat would fall, secondarily the pancreas fat would fall, and the insulin-producing cells would wake up. And to my utter astonishment, that's exactly what we found. So we couldn't disprove the hypothesis. We had demonstrated that it was a highly likely sequence of events. So that was the birth of type 2 diabetes as a potentially simple reversible condition back in 2011.
And how do you put this into effect in nutritional terms?
Well, in designing that first study, the Counterpoint study, I was faced with a problem. In order to test the hypothesis, we had to get people to lose about 15 kilograms in weight. Now, that figure came from almost a back-of-the-envelope calculation on my part as to what I thought would shift the fat out of the liver. Now, I knew the dietetic work that had been done on obesity for a long time and was horrified that the idea had settled into place in conventional nutrition, that the best way to lose weight was just to cut back a little each day and gradually bring it down. And I knew that did not work. Very few obesity clinics published their audit of their outcomes because the outcomes were terrible.
Yeah.
But I also knew of old work with low-calorie diets, which had proved to be very successful. So we used a low-calorie liquid diet, and that has a remarkable property of not being associated with terrible hunger after the first 36 hours or so. So that's one of the two big problems dealt with. The other big problem of dieting and losing weight is the matter of the day-to-day cumulative burden of choice. Can I eat this? How much of that? Is that really a level teaspoonful? Just a little more won't harm me. It gets to people after a while. And I've heard this from my patients over the decades. So we got around that by using a no-choice method. It was a packet for breakfast, a packet for lunch, a packet for dinner. You could choose the flavours, but it was a packet, and that's it. Together with non-starchy vegetables to keep the bowels happy, to give people something to chew on. And that proved to be enormously successful. I was aiming for 15 kilograms weight loss in 8 weeks. In fact, the average weight loss was 15.3 kilograms over
That's
those 8 weeks.
Extraordinary level of weight loss, isn't it?
It is. And indeed, that raises anxieties amongst dietitians because they've been brought up to believe that rapid weight loss can be harmful. Well, there is no such evidence. It's one of these ideas that grows up without any substantial basis. And we now know that this approach is associated with an increase in especially cardiovascular health and no disbenefit that we can detect.
Now, I mean, there are various different ways of going about weight loss, but do you think that, I mean, we're basically talking creating a soup, creating a drink to achieve it. Are there other ways that could still be effective?
Yes, certainly. The only important thing is to reduce the weight, which is reducing the total amount of fat in the body. Mm. And any method of weight loss which an individual finds is working for them, for them to lose about 15 kilograms in weight, will be successful. And so using a low-fat diet is entirely possible. Using a low-carbohydrate diet is entirely possible. Intermittent fasting is perfectly acceptable. And of course, at the extreme end of the spectrum, bariatric surgery will do health to people. They can no longer eat. Their stomach size is limited to the size of their thumb if they have a gastric bypass. Mm. So, yes, any way of losing weight will be successful, but everybody has to grasp that this is not a few pounds. This is a substantial amount of weight. They need to get from A to B, and that's the first job.
Yeah. Now, we're seeing diabetes becoming almost normalised in a lot of society. It's not an unusual disease anymore. But we can't go back to being subsistence farmers. I mean, do you think that this is going to be just an ongoing battle where people are just going to have to continually battle against it?
In the present food environment, yes. Sadly, the only instances we've got of diabetes declining in prevalence in populations is when economic disaster occurs, such as after the Second World War, there was a well-documented fall in type 2 diabetes, and in Cuba, which ran into that terrible economic crisis in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. It was perfectly documented with Castro's brilliantly documented health service. And so that was published just a few years ago in the British Medical Journal. And there's an outstanding example of what can happen. But of course, we don't want that to happen. We don't want widespread disasters. How else could it occur? Well, it would be perfectly possible to put in place very reasonable legislation to regulate this undoubted poison that the population is exposed to, of excess calories. And that was encapsulated in the recent childhood health strategy, childhood obesity strategy, which unfortunately was announced with great fanfare by the government in the UK, but was recently just quietly sidelined because it was not felt to be economically feasible. Well, unfortunately, politicians are susceptible to the blandishments of the food industry. They have their own interests to serve. I don't blame them particularly, but we have to recognise we've got a problem. And unless we grasp it, this matter of effectively mass childhood abuse by provision of excess calories is going to continue.
And when you put it in terms like that, it sounds very stark. Do you think that legislation is probably the only way?
I think so. If we look at the example of anything else that's been of this ilk and contentious, such as motorcycle helmets, such as seatbelts, such as cigarette smoking, they've all been subject to voluntary suggestions or codes of conduct, and it doesn't work. To make a mass population move, we have to decide as a democratic society that it's a good thing to promote the health of our children and our adults in order to strive for the greater good. And that is something which is, of course, difficult politically. And it's something that I think we still have to grapple with as a society. But increasingly, the facts are clear for all to see.
Now, this podcast is listened to by a lot of people in the food industry. I wondered, the food industry is concerned with making money. It's a lot of criticism that it's not necessarily as ethical as it could be. What responsibility do you think the food industry needs to bear for rising cases of diabetes? And consequently, how do you think the food industry has a responsibility in helping to fix the problem as well?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to acknowledge the point you made, that the food industry are set up as commercial enterprises, the primary purpose of which is to make money for shareholders, and that's just a fact. However, there are some ethical issues which need to be considered, and it would be far better if it were possible for companies to take joint action, because taking action which would disadvantage them commercially when their competitors are not, I can see, would be difficult. So there is one concept that perhaps should cause some pause for thought amongst the food industry, and that is it had been clear for a long time that cigarettes are injuring health, and that was concealed, that was argued against. We have exactly the same problem with processed food, with added sugar and fat and salt. And the reparations that have had to be paid by the cigarette industry have been very considerable. It would be more difficult to argue that for the food, given that food, after all, is essential for life. But nonetheless, there is perhaps a pragmatic reason for thinking that there would be a good advantage in being the first one to break cover and say, OK, we have taken for instance, the sugar content out of sweet and sour chicken or sweet and sour pork, and you would see that would be removing 60 to 80 grams per portion from the food chain. So those are examples that could be used by the same manufacturer to shout loudly, you know, we recognise that this is a good thing and we're doing it by our product. It could be a way into the market. So I'm hopeful that that will be taken up, notwithstanding my previous point that perhaps the likelihood of it gaining widespread momentum is low without legal backing.
Mm. Okay, a slight tangent to the conversation, if you don't mind. Many medical trials and treatments of the past have been designed through a sort of a white male lens. Is enough known about diabetes in people who aren't male and who aren't white?
Yes, I think it is. Let's start off with the simple business of men and women, because we have approximately 50% of each in the UK. And we know that men will develop type 2 diabetes at a lower BMI than women, about 2 BMI units adrift. So why is that? Well, men are not set up to have stores of adipose tissue. Arguing, perhaps teleologically, there's a very good reason why women need safe stores of extra nutrition to survive pregnancy. The energy cost of pregnancy, for instance, is about 80,000 calories, and it's an amazing act to be able to pull that off. So nature has been very clever in that regard. But one offshoot of that is this discrepancy. So men are more susceptible at any given level of BMI. That's a gender thing, and indeed we have demonstrated and published on gender differences in how fat is handled in the body. Those are details in a way. Between nations, we can take a step back. Type 2 diabetes is the commonest metabolic disease of humans. It exists in all societies that have been examined who are able to afford excess food, and it even exists across a wide range of species in the animal kingdom. The mechanisms appear to be similar throughout, and certainly we now have clear information that people from Asia and the Far East, if they lose weight, will lose their type 2 diabetes. The same is true in people of Black African heritage, particularly in a Caribbean group which we were privileged to be able to study. So everywhere the hypothesis has been tested, the disease is the same. So we're talking about something very basic in biology here, which isn't surprising, because of course control of energy, keeping ourselves alive, is one of the most basic things about animal physiology. So yes, it's a reasonable question. Is this all too much one gender, or just one particular subgroup of the human race? And the answer is no. This is a universal phenomenon, and I'm very pleased to be able to point to its universality and the potential universal application of solutions.
So a few years ago, I made a documentary in Tonga where we looked at the prevalence of diabetes there, which had become, it was one of the five most obese countries in the world, and it had correlating high levels of obesity. Now, in Tonga, having a big man as the head of the household was immensely important, but obviously it was, you know, they were subsistence farmers and fishermen originally. You would, in the shops in Tonga, you go and buy these vast cans of Spam and vast cans of corned beef, and the favourite meal is lamb flaps, or it certainly was when I was there, which is basically lamb ribs. The tastiest food on the planet, because masses of saturated fat, lots of salt on it, and a little bit of meat in there. But these things were tied into the culture. I guess not originally, because they wouldn't have had a lamb there, but it was sort of being dumped there by New Zealand, because lamb breast wasn't really something that the British wanted to import. But these things become a cultural, huge cultural step to take, to change. And do you find people saying, well, I just can't do it. It's part of my lifestyle. You know, do I really want to tip my life over into something that it isn't and change myself and my family and the way that we live? Do you have to threaten them by saying, well, you're going to die otherwise?
No, never. My role as a doctor is to provide the information, yeah, not for potential choices.
You never threaten. Not even a
never,
little bit.
Never. No. In fact, we know it doesn't produce an effect, because this has been looked at with mentioning blindness in type 2 in diabetes of both kinds. It doesn't make any difference to the actual behaviour, which is interesting in its own right. But no, threats are not there. But you raise a really interesting point. First of all, in many societies, there is a big person culture. It's not uniquely male. Mm. If you look across rulers in Africa and look at the female rulers, you'll see relatively few slight, small ladies. So this is a very basic thing, but it's amenable to change. And if we look at, back to the UK, managing directors, originally, they would all look like the fat controller, dare I say, with a bulging waistcoat. And that was part of the very colourful phrase, avoir du poids, you have gravitas. And that was expected. Whereas now, the open-necked chief executives work out at the gym and take good care to keep their weight down. So you see, they still have power. They still are able to control the boardroom. But that's been shed. So it's perceived as necessary. With cultural shifts, it can change. Mm-hmm. It remains a genuine barrier in some parts of the world, and that's a problem. We were lucky enough to carry out a study in Barbados, which has got an intensely food-centered culture. And there we found that the possibility of losing weight was there. We demonstrated that the type 2 diabetes could be put into reverse and remission could be achieved, but it was very difficult to maintain it in the face of an environment that was overtly tilted towards pouring in the calories. Mm. If you visit a person's house, you're given a Bayesian plate, which is a plate piled high with food, and it's rude not to finish it. You can see the problems, and we just have to acknowledge these. And so this is a softly sort of matter. We can't achieve major societal changes overnight, but we can try and nudge things forward and point out how health can be improved.
Would you say that, that part of the problem of getting people to change their diet and reversing it, part of the problem of getting people there and to lose this 15 kilos that you recommend, is the fact that people don't see that there is a way of solving the problem? You know, I did a quick run around websites before we started talking. I would say that 95% of them said there is no cure for diabetes. So with that in people's mind, I would imagine that the impetus, that the drive to lose weight just isn't there, because people will think, well, it says all the information I have says that this is incurable. Here I am. Why would I bother changing?
Absolutely. And that is a very good point. But we've got to recognise that these are people with type 2 diabetes. Many people say to me, the moment I was told I had diabetes, it was like a hammer blow. Suddenly, your health has left you. You're labelled. You're a diabetic. You need to go to see the doctor often. You need to take pills. You need to worry. Well, that is a burden to a lot of people. And the possibility of achieving salvation, escaping from this otherwise lifelong condition, is very attractive, and people will go to considerable lengths to do it, provided they understand the basis of it. So my task has been to try and explain clearly just what's involved. That this is largely possible in the early years of type 2 diabetes. It's not easy, but it can be done, and it's not associated with the terrible problems that other diets have been associated with, such as hunger and deprivation for a long period of time. This is a short period of time you can plan for. Critically, we can point out the need to have support from family and friends during that weight loss. So these are, and also I have to mention, we ask people not to increase their exercise levels during the weight loss. Exercise makes very little difference to calorie balance, especially when we consider that the people getting type 2 diabetes are usually not in the youngest part of their adult life, and also they've put on a bit of weight since they were in their early 20s, and their capacity to exercise is relatively limited. So we need to strip out this misleading information that exercise can produce weight loss in this group of people, and see that this is something that can be explained in a simple way and able to be done. But as we mentioned before, it's always a choice. It's a choice to embark upon this and be motivated and determined to do it. So I think those are the salient factors. The terribleness of type 2 diabetes makes it possible for people to use a successful method when they know the outcome.
Very good. OK. Now, are you optimistic about any aspects of diabetes treatment in terms of government action, long-term studies, new discoveries that are cropping up? Are you positive in the sense? Because, as you say, losing 15 kilos, it's a dramatic intervention. It won't work for everybody. But are you optimistic about progress in the area?
Yes. It's very slow, but we have to accept that as being a fact of life. But already we have an NHS England diabetes remissions programme in place. The early results have been published. Rather to my surprise, the weight loss was extremely good. In the population-based study, just routine care environment, the average weight loss at 6 months was 13.5 kilograms. That's absolutely outstanding compared with other studies on populations. So, yes, we're underway with a way ahead. We still have to figure out how to keep the weight off. That is the $64,000 question, or possibly the $64 million question. And as regards optimism about legislation, I hope so. We've come as close as we've ever come with the childhood obesity strategy achieving legal status. I think with a further concerted push, we might actually get it over the threshold. And that would be a good thing for the health of this country, and hopefully something that can actually be tested. We can measure the impact of it. Now, the impact of the soft drink levy has been very considerable, much better than was predicted. And that was a reformulation nudge And that was very good. So yes, I'd be optimistic about that. And also, we can be optimistic on one other front, and that is, we've always struggled to find a drug which was really effective in reducing body weight. It has to be something that specifically targets appetite, because that's a problem. Mm. Different people have different amounts of this quantity, this appetite. We can't blame people who become very heavy in a certain environment. It's really just their own genes working through. But to have a magic bullet to be able to change that, a drug to be able to change that, is rather good. And with the recent injectable medications, given usually once a week, showing we get weight losses of around 12, 13 kilograms, that is really very encouraging. Now these drugs are going to be frighteningly expensive for the foreseeable future, but I hope the price will come down. They might be part of the problem, but we also ought to bear in mind, we don't want to medicalize society. We want to try and put in sustainable policies which will prevent us getting to the point where so many people need such drugs. So, am I optimistic? Yes.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to end. Just one last thing. If people want to find out more about diabetes and the treatments that are available, where's the best place to go?
Well, from the point of view of diabetes reversal and achieving remission, then our website, you could Google something like Taylor Diabetes, Newcastle University, then that would be one source. The basic information is there. I wrote a book called Life Without Diabetes, which is available widely. All profits of that book, incidentally, go to Diabetes UK, that provided the first grant, that critical grant that started off the whole programme. And so it's only right that the profits of that book go back to the noble organisation that had the foresight to support this work. But in Life Without Diabetes, I lay out the background of type 2 diabetes using the simple language that I would use talking to people in the clinic, and also explains how to do it. All the details there, even with some recipes that were put together by my fantastic research dietitian, Alison Barnes. So Life Without Diabetes, I think, is a very nice resource. I hate to sound like a commercial, but...
Oh, I'd go for it.
If you want to really understand what's going on here with the cause of type 2 diabetes, how to reverse it, or even if you're enjoying full health, to learn what you do with food after you eat it. That actually is a story that's not widely available, but it's all there. In Life Without Diabetes, you'll understand that there's a double entendre in the title, because it describes normal physiology as well as the possibility of achieving life without diabetes.
And I think you've wrapped up perfectly there, because it's a horrific disease, but there's a strong sense of optimism in our ability to treat it now. So, Professor Roy Taylor, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoyed the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? It was great to have you, and thank you for listening.